From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made the last time you made dinner at home. Did you use olive oil when you cooked? Did you drink wine from Europe? These are not questions targeting only the economic elite. We're talking about $12 bottles. We're talking about a wide range of food and wine. And here's why we're talking about it. The Trump administration is proposing a 100% tariff on all wines imported from the EU, the European Union, along with a 100% tariff on some other goods, like olive oil, even some clothing. A 100% tariff, according to many people working in these industries, would effectively double the price of wine from Europe, along with the cost of any other goods you buy from the EU that are hit with this tariff. Would you stop buying olive oil if the price doubled? Would you stop buying European wine? The Trump administration says the tariff would be a fair response, fair retaliation, for EU subsidies for Airbus. This is part of a trade war, and one of the predicted benefits is a surge in American wine buying. After all, if your favorite wine doubles in price, whether it was a $15 bottle or a $50 bottle, maybe you'll buy something from the United States instead. But American wine producers could be in trouble if their distribution companies go out of business or dramatically reduce staff. American wine producers would be in trouble if stores, wine stores, lay off employees. The chain is a long one. Thousands of jobs could eventually be at stake if this actually happens. And writing for the New York Times, Eric Asimov writes, quote, "Make no mistake, a tariff of that size or any number close to that would be catastrophic for Americans in the beverage and hospitality industry. A 100% tariff would double the price of wines in shops and restaurants with disastrous ripple effects," end quote. Both the European Union and the United States trade representatives have said they want to negotiate a deal. However, the EU has also said it would retaliate against U.S. tariffs. So all of a sudden, American wine producers could be hit with big tariffs when they try to find new customers abroad. Our guests are going to try to sort it out for us this hour. In studio, we welcome Kent Gardner, Chief Economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
And Dan George is with us. He's a wine and spirits representative for T. Edwards Wines and one of the smartest wine minds I know in Rochester. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
I was going to say to Kent, you never met a tariff that you liked, but I don't know if that's true. Do you like some tariffs?
You know, I understand that tariffs have strategic value, and there are, tariffs go back, I mean, in the colonial era in our country, we were running the entire federal government on tariffs. So there are some good reasons to put on tariffs. And, certainly there are, tariffs are only one part of a trade regime. There are many, many things that affect whether our products are more or less competitive and whether other folks' products are more or less competitive. And there are some things we call non-tariff barriers that make it more difficult to sell in one country or another. This whole conversation between Airbus and Boeing, for example, is very, very complicated. And tariffs are a very clear and simple way, in some ways, to respond to what can often be a very complex case.
Let me stop you there, because when we're talking about tariffs and the cost of food and wine, and then you mentioned Boeing and Airbus, it may seem like apples and anvils here to the audience going, what? That's a retaliation in wine for Airbus? Explain what's going on here.
I wish I could.
That's why you're here, Kent. It's the only reason I called you.
Maybe I should go back. So 15 years. I mean, well, this. So we understand that we've got a global duopoly in sophisticated aircraft, and the duopoly is between Airbus and Boeing. And Airbus is a consortium of European countries, and because Airbus is a consortium of governments, the governments actually own a stake. They have an incentive to make sure that Airbus can be effective and competitive in the global marketplace. So the kinds of things that France, Germany, the UK, so forth do to make it easier for Airbus to be successful are judged according to a bunch of very sophisticated rules that the World Trade Organization monitors, and some of them are considered to be fair, and some of them aren't. It's kind of like the Geneva Convention in war. You know, there are some things that are legitimate to do in war and some things that aren't. And so Boeing has been claiming off and on. I mean, they've been in court in the WTO forever. But Boeing started a case a long time ago that claiming that Airbus was getting unfair help from its governments, and therefore that the United States should be empowered under WTO rules to respond and retaliate. And that's the case that just came to closure fairly recently. The WTO said, yes, Airbus has been the recipient of unfair support from the governments that have a part stake in it, and therefore the U.S. has a right to retaliate. So retaliate, you know, you'd like to think we would just slap a tariff on Airbus airplanes, right? And that would be okay. But that's kind of not the way it works in real wars. You know, it's just you use whatever tools are in your toolkit. And in this case, the you know, our government has chosen to retaliate with these particular sets of tariffs on wines and olive oil and the other things that you mentioned.
Yeah. So you kind of fight dirty. You say, okay, how would you like it, Europe, if we if nobody in America bought your wine anymore? And that's sort of the threat here. I mean, it's not that nobody's going to buy the wine, but if you double the price of wine, massive impacts are going to happen here. The concern, and we're going to hear from Dan on this in a moment, the concern that I immediately have is it doesn't really exist in a vacuum, though. I mean, there has to be a chain of impacts here, not just, well, I guess Americans aren't going to buy European wine anymore.
Well, again, this is like pulling out a tactical nuke, right? It says, I've got this nuke. I've got it, you know, I have it pointed at one of your major cities, and unless you do what I say, I'm going to shoot it off and I'm going to blow up your city. No one actually expects that you're going to get to the point of shooting off the tactical nuke and, you know, and eliminating, you know, Paris. But nonetheless, I mean, you still have that nuke in your arsenal, so it is a credible threat. But I don't think anyone ever expects. I don't think we expect that 100% tariff on wine is actually going to occur. Now, we do have a 25% tariff on wine of certain kinds of wines.
Some wines.
That's already in place right now, and I'm surprised that's lasted as long as it has.
It's been like September, October, I think.
Right. But 100% tariff on wine, I mean, a lot of people have lost a lot of bets betting, you know, in favor of our president's rationality. It isn't really rational to put 100% tariff on wine. Of course, that's one of the things that makes him in some ways, a very effective strategist, because people think he really could be crazy enough to throw 100% tariff on wine. So and we don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, again, the goal is not that it isn't in the interest of the United States to do that, because they do know that they're, you know, the Robert Lighthizer and other people who are advising Trump know that there would be a reaction.
But to stay with that analogy on the nuke, we've got a nuke pointed at Paris. In this analogy, before the nuke even gets to Paris, half of it blows off on the plane and wipes out some of the people on your team. That's the concern I have with a tariff like this. It doesn't just injure the quote-unquote trade opposition. No?
That's exactly correct, and that's why we're having this conversation. It's why we tend to see these trade wars as really being very counterproductive. I mean, you'll find very few economists who actually think this kind of behavior actually works in the long run. That doesn't mean that trade is always fair and that we should reduce all of our tariff barriers and we should allow people to sell whatever they want in our country. I mean, you know, that's, I guess, the challenging part, is that it isn't as though our trading partners are always playing fair. And, you know, the fact that the WTO came out on the side of Boeing in this case suggests that, you know, there were some things that the Europeans were doing for Airbus that they shouldn't have been. Well, it would be nice to just see that rolled back instead of turning it into an outright shooting war.
Okay, so Dan George is the Wine and Spirits representative for T. Edward. Tell us about what T. Edward does, by the way, Dan.
Well, primarily we are an importer of European wines. Our company started in 1994. With just a couple of labels. The owner of our company, Tom Burns, was a sales rep for Monsieur Touton and decided he wanted to create a portfolio of wines that were from small producers in specializing in good farming practice or thoughtful farming practice, not necessarily certified organic or biodynamic at the time, but when you look at our portfolio now, you'll see that a lot of the producers in there are of that criteria, small farming, either bio, organic, or sustainable.
And how much comes from Europe in your portfolio?
Our portfolio is about 50 to 60% European wines, mostly French and Italian, but we do have producers in Spain, producers in Portugal, mm-hmm. producers in Germany, Austria. And yeah, all of those products will be affected.
How seriously are you taking this proposal for a 100% tariff?
Well, our company as a whole is taking it very seriously, and I think, you know, a lot has a lot of what has happened so far has been people speaking out, trying to get a hold of their congressman or senator and voice their opinion that, you know, this is going to affect a lot of people down the chain. Now, for the person that's going to feel it first is the importer. We are going to be the first people to feel the effects of the tariffs. We are the ones who pay the duty at the border mm-hmm. when the containers show up. And for example, right now, most small distributors are gearing up for rosé season. We have, you know, all of our orders typically would be in by now for our rosés. And when they are ready to be put on the water, which is usually within the next 4 to 6 weeks, you'll start seeing some rosés show up even in the next couple weeks. But for us specifically, we usually get our rosés at the end of February, beginning of March. So this whole, even though it hasn't gone through yet, the tariffs are going to affect how we buy. Rosé, the last 3 years, has been our top-selling product, our Provence Rosé.
But it sounds like you're kind of nervous on what orders you want to place. Is that fair?
To a degree, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I can't imagine, Dan, trying to forecast sales with this kind of a change in price. I mean, small changes in price, you know, 10-15%, you probably have enough experience to be able to deal with that. But 100%, it's just, besides that, it's 100%, but we don't know whether it's really going to happen. I mean, it really makes your business almost impossible.
Yeah, it's quite the wrench, so to speak. And right now, I think we are, you know, it's all kind of speculative what's going to happen. But if this does go through, it could, for us as a company, we would make adjustments and probably, I mean, I'm someone who works off 100% commission. I have no safety net. So from my perspective, I already am like planning my year. I'm going to have to sell a lot more mezcal and tequila and things that won't be fall under the tariff. But those other... That will not fill all the void of Châteauneuf-du-Pape or Burgundy or Bordeaux or
Tuscany. So a couple of points on that. So in your rosé season, which is typically summer, even though Dan has made this fruitless argument that you can drink rosé all year round. You actually can't. There's a law against it. Temperature's got to be over 80 degrees. But let's just sort of play this out here. A bottle of rosé may be $12. Could you sell it for $24?
No, I mean
that product wouldn't move.
It would not move. Exactly.
Okay. What about people say, well, fine, then just carry much more American products. About time you start selling more American wine.
Right. And sure, that'll help push some American products a little bit higher as far as volume, sales volume is concerned. But you can't fill the void for Provence Rosé. Nobody else makes rosé like they do in Provence. It's impossible to replicate the effects of the Mediterranean and the French mountains all kind of, you know, acting.
And I'm just going to say this. I know to some people that sounds like that's a pretty elitist thing. In a moment, we're going to bring in Dewi Rainey, who's the owner of a wine shop in Ithaca. And she makes a comparison on this that I'd never heard that I'm going to remember that takes it away from the elitism that I think just makes it more universal. So we'll get to that in a moment here. But before we get to that conversation with Dewi, let me ask you. Are you worried about losing your job?
No, not off.
He really hesitated before he answered that question.
I think for a lot of people, like a lot of smaller importers, T. Edwards is a size where I think we're just big enough to not necessarily absorb the cost of those tariffs because it's going to change the dynamic of our company for sure if they go through. I don't know exactly how. I don't think necessarily people will get laid off because, well, we're commissioned employees anyway. So it's, you know, it's our hard work.
So your income may go down anyway. Okay, sure. But do you have colleagues sort of related to the field that you're worried about their jobs?
Absolutely. 100%. There are a few smaller importers. And you also have to keep in mind, down in Manhattan and the tri-state area, there's a ton of importers that we don't always see upstate. There's a lot of smaller ones who just focus, you know, there's a small importer from Long Island that I've had the pleasure of working alongside of at tastings, and it's a father-son distributor. And it's just, they're the only two employees, and they specialize in Italian wines. That's all they bring in. They have a few dozen labels. If this tariff goes through, there's no way they could weather this. They will be done. Mm-hmm.
So let's listen to some of the conversation with Dewi Rainey, who is the owner of Red Feet Wine Market in Ithaca. And this is what I think is even more particularly interesting about Dewi's position. Dewi is married to Rick Rainey, and Rick is one of the co-owners of Forge Wine Cellars, which is a Finger Lakes producer, one of the most highly regarded by critics. But Rick also works for Wine Bow and has done all kinds of international work. So Rick is an American producer. His wife, Dewi, is the owner of a wine shop. And they've got this stake in sort of American wine, but they're not rooting for this tariff. Now, Dewi's a lot smarter than Rick. That's why we decided to talk to her and not Rick. And this is a chance to hear her perspective. Again, she's the owner of Red Feet Wine Market in Ithaca. Let's listen.
Thanks for having me.
For our listeners who have not been to Red Feet in Ithaca, every business and every wine store is a different size. Describe Red Feet to our listeners.
It's a retail wine and liquor store. We sell international wine, and we've been in business about 13 years, focusing on small family producers that grow and make artisanal wines. And we really feature high-touch customer service. So our specialty is really pairing wines with whatever our clients are cooking. So they normally come in and we end up talking about food and travel and, you know, entertainment. And then we try to find wines that fit their budget. And it's a range of pricings.
You probably have to have a lot of wines in the teens to low teens.
Yes, we sell an amazing amount of wine in the $10 to $15 range. And, you know, it's bought by people at all different levels. I mean, I have doctors who only spend $12 on their bottle of wine. You know, people want to be able to drink it on a daily basis like they would a beer or something. So to them, they don't want to make it a luxury thing that they only touch once in a while. And so we sell a lot in that price range. And Ithaca is a middle class city, and there are lots of graduate students and, you know, young families in the neighborhood. It's not a really wealthy area, so it's very middle class. And so there's a lot of, let's say, for sure under $20, and the majority of it is in the $10 to $15 range. And I even have top customers, and that's all they spend. Some of my top people, that's what they spend because they want to drink more frequently.
So as we talk about the proposed Trump tariffs, I mean, the Trump administration tariffs of a 100% tariff on European wines, among some other products, by the way, and there are other products on the list, but we're focusing mostly on wines today. So 100% tariff, what percentage of your business at Red Feet comes from European wines?
It is about 70%. We actually sell the most wine from France and then Spain and then Italy. And then the fourth through the sixth positions are basically a tie between the Finger Lakes, Portugal, and California. So it's a big chunk of our business.
I wonder if some listeners might think, okay, well, now you're just going to have to sell more domestic wines and just swap out some of your European wines for American wines if this tariff goes through. Could you do that?
I mean, we try to find as much as we can that are value wines from the New World, and from that includes the U.S., of course. And it is tough in the 15 and under range to find anything from California that's really good and that's made by other than a huge operation. So, you know, we find wines from South America. We can find some from South Africa that could be in that $10 to $15 range. But in the U.S. and including in the Finger Lakes and in Washington State, these wines are more expensive than that. So the daily drinkers are going to be not accessible in that range. The other thing is that the U.S. and these New World countries, everybody's going to be trying to expand their selection of them. And I'm not even sure there are enough. And it's going to be very competitive to, you know, search out and find interesting, artisanal, well-made wines in the lower price ranges. So it's really going to affect the consumer because the consumer is just going to have to pay more, and their selection is going to be way down. Additionally, a lot of American wines are distributed through the same companies that have a big position in European wines. So if they lose a large part of their business, like 40 to 50% of their business sales are vastly decreased, that's going to affect their entire operation, their numbers and their warehousing and their trucking systems and deliveries and their salespeople and their ability to get these American wines out to the public. And besides, I really feel like competition is a good thing. So, you know, I think everybody really wants for there to be just free trade in both directions and not, you know, have the advantage to them, whether it's temporary or whatever, falsely created.
Talking to Dewi Rainey, the owner of Red Feet Wine Market in Ithaca, about this proposed 100% tariff on European wines that the Trump administration has considered, along with some other products. Now, it would not be an impact on prices immediately, because there are companies that are essentially trying to stock up on what they have under the idea that if this tariff passes, if you've got stuff already in-house, that's not going to get hit with the tariff. It's stuff that you order in the future. So, I mean, I know there's a lot to sort of work out there, but let me ask you a question about, like, let's go forward 12 months, 24 months after this tariff hits, and if you've sold down your stock and you're dealing with it here, a 100% tariff, does that effectively double the price of European wines, or could you eat some of that in-house?
I cringed when you said go forward 12 months or more, but that is, you know, I think what will happen. I don't think it'll be a short-lived thing, and I know a lot of people in my industry were kind of, you know, sleepy about this when it was first announced in early to mid part of December, because they were hopeful that it was just so unprecedented that there's no way that could happen. But we've already seen tariffs that have lasted 18 months. The tariffs are paid when the goods land in port. So that means the importer who brings them in, who has bought them, has to then go out and upfront pay cash to take those goods in. So a lot of small companies, first of all, will go out of business because they do not have the money to front these things 100% more than what they were paying. The tariff previous to this had been something like 15 cents a bottle. So now on a $20 bottle of wine, you're talking about raising that like 130%. So you're going to pay $20 to even take it in. It's going to be really tough for the importers, and the small guys are going to fall off, which means, you know, a lot of cool little wines will just not be available to us. For me, my numbers don't work if my sales drop, because we've been trying over the years. I've been in business 13 years. So healthcare costs for our staff, all of our costs are constantly rising. And if anything, we've been really working to try to get our sales up by having special events and, you know, finding really interesting wines that we can buy a little deeper and feature, or, you know, other methods. We can't afford a drop of 10%, 20%, 30%, or whatever it's going to be, because people have to look to alternatives, or you know, they just stop buying these products. You know, they just can't do it. I mean, for a while, they'll go and buy, you know, wines from the New World, and they'll try them. But I don't feel like these wines are necessarily interchangeable. There's a lot of special, you know, tradition and experience and terroir that is unique to Europe. And although there are wonderful products from the U.S. and the New World, they don't necessarily replace one another, just like types of music don't replace one another. If you love a certain type of music, that's what you love. So it's going to be really tough for retailers. First, it's going to hit the producer in Europe, who has taken a big position in selling in the U.S., but they can actually go out and find other countries to eventually, maybe not in the first year, but to sell to, whether it's China or distribute to other parts of the world. Then the distributors and the importers, many of whom that I really respect, they're heroes to me, have taken huge positions in Italy and France, or Spain. They specialize in that. Their employees have dedicated their lives to educating themselves and taking advanced classes and things like that on these areas. That's going to really affect them. I mean, you know, doubling the price of a wine that's already more expensive is going to put it completely out of reach. Then it sort of goes down to me, the retailer, as well as restaurants. And restaurants, there are quite a few food items on here too, and I don't know how much restaurants are really thinking about this yet, but food prices in restaurants could go up because there are a lot of specialty EU goods, whether it's cheese or olive oil or olives or jams, things like that, that are on this list for a possible 100% tariff. So, you know, we're going to be affected next. And then finally, the consumer is the last one to be affected. And consumers aren't really necessarily getting rattled about this yet, but we really have it on our mind. We're very worried and concerned. So I employ a full-time manager, and then I have five other staff members, and some of them have worked for me the whole time, the entire 13 years, but I have many that have been there 5 to 12 years as well. So these staff members of mine are people who have families. They are the breadwinner in some cases. They have own their own homes, and they have car payments. And when I talk about this, that's just my retail store. At the level above me, the distributors and importers, those salespeople make good money. It's affecting the people who actually trade in these goods in addition to the final consumer. So all of us who trade in these goods, those are pretty nice middle class jobs. Nobody knows what will happen, Evan. There could be, you know, we might be using this as a negotiating tool, and let's say it's not going to be all EU countries. It'll be just the initial four that had the Boeing subsidies given out. And so that would be France, Spain, Germany, and the UK, which we don't have any wines from the UK. It could be just them. Or maybe they'll say it's all EU, but it's only 50%. And then everybody will, I guess, be sort of relieved that it's not 100, but it still messes up the entire model, you know, and makes it not doable. But we don't know. There's so much uncertainty right now. So even now, we are waiting for a decision, which I think I heard was going to come by February 15th. And then we'll have to make a plan. And we'll have to adjust as we hear what it is.
Thanks for taking the time, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Evan. It's always nice to talk to you.
That's Debbie Rainey, the owner of Red Feet Wine Market in Ithaca. And so there's a lot there. First of all, I want to kind of, after our only break of the hour, hit that the question of the impact that you can't measure it in hard numbers, but I wanted to get Kent Gardner's take a little bit more on when she talks about business uncertainty here in the United States, given this. We'll also talk to Dan George from T. Edward Wines about the idea that, well, if it's just a 50% tariff, is it time to celebrate? Or is that like, you know, the kid who asked his parents for a $20 allowance when he's really looking for $10? So there's a lot there. And we're going to try, as I'm going to continue to try to figure out what the best case for this tariff would be, too, in the best faith that I can, because I don't have Joe Tariff Supporter here, but I would like to at least try to explore that. So on the other side of this break, more of the economics lesson that we're getting from Kent Gardner, the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research, Dan George, Wine and Spirits representative for T. Edward Wines. Coming up in our second hour, it's the opening of Dialogue on Disability Week at WXXI, and throughout the week on Connections, we've got a series of conversations about inclusion and disability rights. Next hour, we discuss speech therapy with a local mother whose child has received services from a wide range of agencies. We'll talk about what's working, what the community ought to know about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you're just joining us, the Trump administration is floating the idea of a 100% tariff hitting all European wines along with other products. Could be clothing, could be products of food products, cheeses, olive oil, things like that, which a 100% tariff could effectively double the price you pay for those goods. And we're not just talking about the highest of the high-end wines. I mean, we're talking about $10, $12 wines would now be $20, $24. I mean, you're going to spend that much money if you're used to a certain price. So a lot of impacts here for importers, distributors, wine producers, but this is just part of sort of the larger trade fight. And before I get back to our guests in studio to react to what they just heard, let me squeeze in Jane, who's been waiting to weigh in as well. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. I don't know much about tariffs, but let me ask a couple of questions. I heard that Bill Gates had requested that he be exempted from the tariff. This is a few weeks ago. And his reason was, I don't understand it, but his reason was that he could not compete globally if he had to pay that. And I thought, well, if he can't compete, who can? And I'm just wondering if how these decisions are made. Are they arbitrarily made by no one but Trump? Who weighs in on these things? I mean, there are millions of products. So it would be not unlike him to use these the tariff as a power play with his donors, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so you would exempt maybe Bill Gates because he's possibly a big donor. So I'm curious about that, if you could tell me.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. That's why Kent's here. So I imagine the president has a lot of discretion when it comes to policy, but also people advising. Who's really making the call on tariffs?
Yeah, the president has enormous power when it comes to setting tariffs. You know, that happens within the context of some laws. But as we've learned, I think, with this particular president, the president can make decisions. And even though there are others who probably should have been consulted and probably have a stake in the issue and have some legal power to get involved, it's not necessarily a quick rebuttal. So it's not possible for Congress to swoop in and say this is a bad idea and we're going to reverse this particular set of tariffs. So it's the president. We have a very powerful executive under the Constitution. I think we're just realizing in this presidency just how powerful that executive power really is.
Jane, thank you for that. And on the subject of, you know, can he carve out for friends or donors, I thought the story that came out in the Wall Street Journal last week was remarkable, and I just want Kent's take on it. I briefly mentioned it on the air, but the Wall Street Journal reported on the story of Robert Weatherby, who is a metal fabricator, the owner of a metal fabrication plant and manufacturing firm, essentially in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area. He is a big supporter of Donald Trump. His plant employs more than 100 people. And Weatherby told the Wall Street Journal that steel tariffs could force his plant to close and him to go out of business. And here is what he said about tariffs. He said, "Tariffs are blunt instruments and have harmed many American companies, including my own." He says, "Our Midland, Pennsylvania plant is now hemorrhaging money because of the tariffs." So what he told the Wall Street Journal was, "I still like the president. I'll support the tariffs, but I'm just going to apply for an exemption for my company."
Yes, indeed.
What did you make of that?
Well, what I make of it is that this is a person who is reminding the president the people who support him and voted for him stand to lose big time from some of the actions he's taking.
And yet we'll vote for him no matter what, just about.
Well, we'll have to see whether Weatherby gets his exemption, right? Maybe if he gets his exemption, he'll keep his vote. But again, I think that there's not a lot of rational thought when it comes to tariffs. I mean, this is a very kind of red-blooded America First kind of issue, and that certainly is the base to which this president has been reaching out. And that's one of the challenges. As you said, you don't have Joe Tariff supporter on the call or on the show today. I am generally supportive of free trade, and I think that trade in general benefits us all. But there are lots of people who disagree, and there are a lot of people who would like to see us raise 100% tariffs for everything, so that everything that we consume is produced in the United States. The flip side of that, of course, is that everything we produce is going to have to be purchased by people in the United States because the rest of the world won't take that. So if we have 100% tariff on French wines, I would expect that the French would put a 100% tariff on California wines and on Finger Lakes wines.
Yep.
and on other products that we sell. I mean, I thought it was interesting after the steel and aluminum tariffs that the president imposed, I think in 2018, that the EU responded and they said, well, let's see, how about Kentucky bourbon and Harley Davidson's? And, you know, this is back when Paul Ryan was Speaker of the House. And guess whose plant is in Paul Ryan's district? Well, my, it just happens to be Harley Davidson. I wonder how that happened. This is a nasty war. People,
and we are inviting creative retaliation.
We're doing our own little bit, and we're inviting them to do similarly. And you know, how can you blame them? Now, if we're going to impose 100% tariffs on French wines, how would President Macron survive?
He'd be a fool to say, well, that sounds good to me.
Yes,
we'll do nothing.
or to say, oh, well, we understand the poor Americans are getting beat up here and we're just going to accept this, right?
So, but Kent, let me close the loop on Jane's call before I turn back to Dan here, which is that she's essentially asking if trade policy can be gamed to help friends, or at least carved out to help friends. And the analog, I think, with the wine tariff would be something like, let's say the owner of T. Edwards, who I don't know who that is, let's say Dan's company is owned by one of the biggest Trump supporters, which I assume is not the case. No. Okay. But for the sake of it, you know, Joe Wine Company is owned by one of the big Trump donors, and he comes out just like Weatherby says to the Wall Street Journal, which is, hey, I'm a big Trump supporter. I'm getting killed by this tariff. We may go out of business, but hey, I'm literally gonna publicly campaign now for exclusions. I think Jane is just asking, is that the kind of thing that could happen?
Yeah, honestly, I don't know the extent of the president's discretion or Robert Lighthizer or those trade representatives' discretion
with respect
to these, but they could certainly try. And you know, again, I think we have just not understood just how powerful the executive is in this, under this Constitution until now.
So, Dan, Dewey's point about music, I think, is valuable because I'm thinking about down the hall on Classical 91.5. If we told Classical 91.5 listeners, listen, we can't afford to give you classical music anymore. We're just going to put hard rock on. And I'm thinking of all the classical listeners. Do you think they go, well, there's music, so I'll listen. I'll still. Similarly, if I went over to CMF and I said, CMF, you got a lot of fans here. Like what you're doing. But we're going to have you play classical. We can't afford to do hard rock. You know, WDKX, you're going to have to change your format entirely. Music is a good example here. When people say, well, just buy different wines. People do like what they like. And just assuming that your industry could handle a massive change, we'll just start selling all half your portfolios Europe. We'll just do 100% from Australia and the United States. You'd have a lot of customers who'd go, I still like hard rock, or I still like classical. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah, people's palates, so to speak, have developed over time. It's taken them a long time to get to this point. I remember when I first started drinking wine, it was, what was, you know, $7. What could I buy for $7? And it was usually at the time Australian Wolf Blass Cab or Shiraz. But I hadn't really developed a palate yet. I didn't understand all the little important things that make up this wine industry. And I mean, there's so much embedded in a bottle of wine, culturally speaking. And I think that Dewey's point to music is spot on. I don't think there's a better analogy that I've heard so far.
Yeah.
But let me push back a little bit. I mean, I think that there are an awful lot of us who don't, you know, spend as much as you folks do for wine. You know, I wish I felt I could afford to spend more. I like nice wine. I think that for the mass market, most people would probably shift to a different source and would shift away from European wines.
I think the point there being that it's not 100%, that you have a non-zero number that's significant enough to do serious damage that has an expectation of a certain product.
Well, let's go back to one other point. I think you were getting to this earlier, Evan, and that is that let's assume that the 100% tariff doesn't happen. Because again, I think that's the most likely outcome.
I'd like to ask both of you about this. If this just goes, well, we'll just do 50%.
Well, or that it gets reversed entirely. I mean, think about the negotiations that have been going on with China, right?
Sure.
Some really drastic trade remedies with China. And now suddenly somehow we've got some kind of an agreement, so this stuff isn't going to happen? Or I don't know. The difficulty is, let's assume it doesn't happen, but think about how much time and effort and money and stomach acid is being expended now because of the fear of that occurring. That has a real cost for the American consumer. It has real cost for American businesses. Business relies on a certain amount of predictability. And one of the things that, I don't think this president understands is that when you throw a spanner in the works, you cause some real damage. Even if later you decide, I didn't mean it. So it can be tremendously damaging and costly.
Okay. How do you feel, Dan, if we end up seeing a situation where the administration, but let's take that example that Dewey gave. Maybe it's 50%, a 50% tariff. Would your industry celebrate that because it's done 100?
I don't think so. Not at all. The even 50%. Well, let's take like restaurants, for example. Restaurants barely make any money on food alone. It's really fractions of a percent when you look at the cost of labor,
their
insurance.
Their margin comes from the drink.
Their margin comes almost exclusively from behind the bar or the tap or behind, you know, the cork, if you will. So those margins, restaurants will be hit very hard. Obviously, wine shops too, because the margins for Spanish or Portuguese right now. Portuguese wines are relatively inexpensive, and they're getting better, and they're in that price range, like, you know, that are still affordable, you know, $8 to $12, those will now be $14 to $20.
And so recognize that there are also some winners on this, and that's the thing. Anytime you impose a tariff, I mean, I'm sure that most California vintners are worried. They feel that they could be next. I mean, again, they would worry about a retaliatory tariff from France, but also their ability to charge more for their better wines will improve. And that's going to be true for importers from other parts of the world as well. So, you know, it's not that they're all losers. Again, I would be surprised to find total wine consumption decline. I suspect that total wine consumption after an adjustment period would probably stay roughly where it is right now, but the composition would be very different, and there would be significant dislocations for individuals in the industry.
Okay.
I think that is accurate in a way, and also a little misleading, because Europe right now, or the EU, well, they're importing, or what they import, domestic or American wine, is it's less than 1%. It's very small comparatively to how much we take in.
Well, yes, but again, I mean, first to the question, would total wine consumption actually decline? I guess that's my first question. I suspect it would not.
Or I would suspect it would, but not in a large amount.
Not in a large amount.
I think that's fair.
I think the most of the market would probably adjust. There are some people who would not, but most of the market would adjust. So, you know, that doesn't mean that it's a good policy just because the market would adjust until wine consumption wouldn't decline. You know, it still can be a crazy policy, and I think it would be a policy that would reduce the competitiveness of the U.S. wine market, probably the competitiveness of the domestic market. But I am very interested in what you just said, that the Europeans import only maybe 1% of California wines. Is that because California wines aren't worth importing?
I think it has to do with, no, I don't think that's the case. I think it's also the diversity of the wines that they have at their in their backyard, and then also throwing in California wines are very expensive. The ones worth drinking are very expensive, or becoming more expensive. They have over the course of the last 5 years because of wildfires that have burnt down half of Sonoma and Napa. So the real premier wine areas have seen kind of devastation from natural causes.
But yeah, this is where we could get really wonky on the wine stuff. But I do think, to the extent that you can speak monolithically about it, which is a precarious thing, there's a diversity of wines even from California, even at different alcohol levels. But if you want to do that, Europeans think about American wines in this Parkerized style, which just means bigger, higher alcohol, more jammy, and a lot of, generally speaking, the European palate prefers something different. And so, and it probably also has something to do with the 1976 International Wine Competition, which is silly, but it's this idea that California beat Paris in this international competition. And so you get a bit of a Homerism. There's a lot of factors that might reduce sales in American wines to begin with. But I can definitely tell you, American producers, whether it's here or California or Missouri, they want to export. They'd love to have markets opening up in other places. And this does them no favors if they want markets to open.
That does not make it easier for them, for sure.
No, that's true. But let's also try to make a populist case now for tariffs. Okay. For those who say, I want 100% tariffs on everything. I am sick of us with this trade deficit. Put up a damn wall. I don't care. We should be doing everything that we possibly can in this mainland United States.
Well, yeah. Do you like to eat bananas? You know, how are you on some of the other?
I can shift. I'll eat something else. Look, I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Okay, yeah, so that's fine. So that's bananas. Let's see. You know, what about cars? Are you perfectly happy with American cars?
I like American-made cars.
You like American-made cars. We're going to take all the European components out of the American-made cars, right?
We'll make components here.
We'll make better components here, right?
Yeah.
Right. So we could go down this path, but there are things. We get to certain things like certain kinds of specialty minerals that we don't actually have in the United States. So even in that case, there are
grow them, plant them,
plant these new minerals. Yeah, that's right. So we would lose, and that's again the free trade case, is that even if we could manage to produce, we could grow bananas in the United States. We could do that. We actually
be a lot more.
It'd be a lot more expensive to grow expensive. Than in the United States. One of the things that we do in the United States, incidentally, that that we shouldn't is sugar. We grow sugar cane, and one of the problems with the Everglades, for example, is that we grow a lot of sugar in Florida, and that's because we have non-tariff barriers that keep out foreign sugar. We should be buying sugar from Latin America, but that's one of the things that we have historically done. We protected sugar producers in the United States, so you know our hands are already dirty on this. We should be freeing up a lot of markets, not just the wine market.
What would surprise you in that, given your sentiment as an economist, as Kent is, the reason Kent's an easy invite for this is it would be hard for me to find any economists who love tariffs and love borders. Now, I'm sure there are some, but most of the time, no matter the political persuasion or personal views of economists, there's a real hesitance to see tariffs deployed like this. So what would surprise you then? If the what would convince you, well, this sort of worked, this 100% tariff thing with Europe worked?
Well, let's rather than talking about that particular tariff, let's take a look at the trade war with China, right? You know, we've been very concerned about China's willingness to steal, bluntly, U.S. technology. And a lot of the tech companies in the United States have been very concerned about China for a very long time. You've set up a shop in Shanghai or Guangzhou, and suddenly you have to turn over the technology to your domestic partner in China. That's an unfair trade practice. And I think that getting tough with China has really been a good policy, and it's been overdue. And a lot of Europe has cheered us getting tough with China. So I think you could argue that some of the president's actions with respect to China will be beneficial for the United States in the long haul. It's very hard to understand. And you know, using tariffs in this particular way is also an attempt to extract something, except that the thing at this point is something I think we're all having a very difficult time figuring out.
What is that thing that we're trying
what
to?
What is that thing?
I'm trying to extract here. Chris on Twitter, a question for Dan says, and I think this touches on maybe the point that Kent was making. If you see the tariffs go through, he says, we'll also see American producers and other importers from South America, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, incrementally increase their wholesale prices because the EU wines will then be artificially overpriced.
I think that could definitely happen. It probably will. They maybe not right away and not in large numbers, but like you said, incrementally, that would make sense for them.
Well, they could see an opportunity.
Absolutely.
Because if Dan and I are both selling $15 wine and all of a sudden you're selling $30 wine, I could say, well, I can sell mine for $20 and still be $10 less than Dan and see that. But if that happens, I do feel like we're eventually going to start to chase people away from wine entirely.
Well, that's also another possibility. Sure, we could chase people to beer. We could chase people to non-alcoholic beverages. We could chase people to hard liquor. You know, certainly there's a lot of substitutability there. So, I mean, my suggestion that, you know, you increase tariffs by 100% on European wines and there will be no change in wine consumption, that's certainly not true. Because there are a lot of other places people can go.
Okay, and in our last couple of minutes, I want to conclude with some of the point that Eric Asimov was making in his New York Times piece. Because he writes that there's a lot of talk about the actual winemakers, the wine producers, and again, it sort of creates this sort of elite bubble. He writes, the fear about this should not stop with importers. An entire chain of businesses are built around the acquisition and sale of European wine and food, from distributors to retail shops and restaurants and all associated workers, dock labor, forklift drivers, and others. Asimov is saying, when we think about tariffs, don't just think in a limited way. Do you agree with that, Kent?
Again, I think there would be a reshuffling, and so some of the people who are active in this particular market would find other businesses. You know, perhaps Dan will have to import something else or go into a different business entirely. And this is what happens when prices and technology change. You know, the availability of particular products does change over time, usually for natural means, not for artificial means. This is an artificial way of changing the relative price of a particular product. We do adjust to these changes in the economy. We don't usually do it because we've been forced to.
Okay. Dan, thoughts from you on that? Final thoughts there.
The point, I think, is that so many more layers of people will be affected by it. I think the initial layperson, they see that we're going to hit with these tariffs, these wine tariffs, and they think, oh, whatever. It's just people of a certain class, like wine is a class.
Expensive wine.
Or something that actually, but something that bothers me a lot is, yeah, like wine is a luxury item. I have a hard time with that statement because so many people for so long, thousands of years, have drank wine, and it's something that everybody has had access to.
And most of it was really awful.
Most of it was terrible. But it was still fermented grapes. And
I think the point you're making is wine can be a luxury item.
It can be,
but
absolutely.
It also can be in the category that is more accessible to a much larger proportion.
I think more times.
And that's a lot of what you sell.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So what are you going to do about this? 20 seconds. What happens next? What do you want to see done?
I would like to see the tariffs not go through. If they do, obviously we'd like to see a much more reasonable...
But do you feel relatively powerless in this?
At this point, yeah. I think up until last week when we had the open forum, using social media to get people out there was... Or to get people to voice their opinion was the strongest thing we could have done up until that point.
Okay. And Kent, do you think these are going to go through like this?
I don't think so, no. I'm hoping.
But you never say never with this
administration. Never say never with this administration. And that's one of the things that arguably makes Donald Trump a very effective negotiator is because you really don't know whether he might launch those tactical nukes.
Kent Gardner, chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Thank you, as
always.
Thank
you, Evan.
What are you drinking tonight, Dan George?
Probably some Spanish natural wine.
Smoke them while you got them. Dan
Maybe
George
a pet nat.
T. Edward Wine.
Probably a pet nat or two.
Don't say a pet nat. Don't you dare do that. Coming right back on Connections.